top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 371 of the Really Awful Movies podcast, Zola from 2020. This is a suggestion from my pal on Instagram, Megan, who's out in British Columbia. So props for sending that along. Really, really interesting flick, and it's something I'd not heard of. So this is a film whose genesis stems from, of all things, a Twitter rant. This almost stream of consciousness, multiple Twitter, word vomit that happened, I think, 3 or 4 years ago. And it actually then transmogrified into what you are able to witness on Prime and on Netflix. And it's a film that I've seen described as Spring Breakers meets Pulp Fiction, which I think is really, really apt, as I was actually going to touch on the Quentin Tarantino aspect of it a little bit later, but I think I may do so now. I mean, Zola is a film that is rooted in the 70s, but has an entirely and wholly modern sensibility, and it is of its time in a way that I think with Tarantino's work, with the kind of smirking, ironic, and distanced attitude that he takes, it kind of takes you out of it, because you always are under the impression with a Tarantino film, for the most part, not some of his really latter work like Django or whatever, but you always get the impression you are watching a movie, and it's because he puts his words so front and center that you can't help but think you're listening to characters being there merely as vehicles for his voice. By contrast, this one is it definitely has an exploitation sensibility, but is thoroughly modern in terms of the technical side of things too. So it's really quite ingeniously filmed, although it definitely has some of those exploitation elements. And it almost begs the question, like, what is exploitation? And you could put it in the passive voice as a film that, well, wherein someone is exploited. And it's a questionable or ambiguous whether that is actually even the case with this one. So Zola is the tale of, and depending on who you believe, I mean, there's a lot of it that's kind of murky and sort of nebulous, but the two principals are part-time strippers who meet over breakfast at a Hooters restaurant. And it's just one of these things where these two worlds collide, of these two people who have a lot more in common than most people would, but wherein one of the background of the one character, who's referenced repeatedly here as the white bitch, this almost Tarantino-esque language here, but she's a one who has this, I guess, lead that involves going down south, and things do actually go south quick, but she has this lead wherein she can, get tons of money in a short amount of time. And this is actually almost par for the course in one of those film noirs from the 50s or 60s or 40s, where someone has an idea for something and then they have to act on it. And the storytelling in this film is actually so self-contained and so tight and taking place over the span of 48 hours, I believe, that it's just unbelievable how it works. Like, it really shouldn't work, because there's no character arc to speak of. And the fact that it was generated out of a Twitter rant means that they had, they did have a core story in which truth is stranger than fiction. So they had a lot of details to work with. And of all papers, the Democracy Dies in Darkness, right? That's its motto. The Washington Post actually fact-checked a lot of this. So what you have is these two women bonding in this restaurant. One has a pimp and says, like, there's this club in Tampa, Florida, where you can make piles of money in a short amount of time. So that as a proposition entices the other one, and they exchange a couple of fun FaceTime or Snapchat, whatever the platform was, messages, and become more closely acquainted. And the one, on whom this story is based, his nickname is Zola. She's the an African-American woman who's, I guess, has one foot in the game, or one high-heeled boot in the game. And the other trying to, you can almost say, go legit in a way. I mean, this is just rife with exploitation film premises from the past. And this coalesces around this almost, like, this is a road trip, right? Again, the Spring Breakers illusion. You have these people who go down to Florida to make money real quick. And had this been made in the 50s, this would have been a bank heist. So you have all these different machinations happening. And once they actually get to their destination, well, you know, this shouldn't be a surprise that things are actually not what they seem. And I wrote back to Megan and said, this reminds me of a film, although very different tonally, called A Beautiful Island, by a female director from Spain. Okay, A Most Beautiful Island. And the director's name is Ana Asensio, and she's from Madrid, Spain, I believe. And in that one, you have a similar setup whereby someone who's more on the down and out side of the spectrum, of the on the you know, the economic spectrum, she is struggling and is in fact a migrant and needs to make money fast in order to put a roof over her head. And she actually comes across a Ukrainian national named Olga in the Bronx, and she has a quick way to make money, and this involves a series of events that lead to an almost quasi Eyes Wide Shut kind of a denouement for that one. So there are parallels between the two films insofar as you have these two characters meeting and then having to, I mean, they're already on the cusp of being in the demi-monde anyway, but you have one being introduced to another and pulling them into this underworld. And tonally, they're completely at polar ends, because in A Most Beautiful Island, it's very, very dour, very, very dark, very, very bleak. By contrast, there's a lot more, chattiness and moral agency given to the two strippers in this one, and they are actually quite well-rounded characters in a way that you don't typically get from someone who's a sex worker or a hooker or a prostitute. I'm thinking back to maybe the Mira Sorvino, Michael Rapaport, Woody Allen film, just off the top of my head. There's plenty. You could throw Taxi Driver in there as well, where you have a prostitution angle in there, but with the Mira Sorvino character from Mighty Aphrodite, she's more of one of these naive dimwits, and that is, it is par for the course for the what little experience I have in engaging with strippers. It's actually kind of funny. We usually record our podcast from Jeff's condo south of here. I'm just outside of the core in Toronto, but within about five or six blocks, I want to say, of my apartment, I'm near two strip joints, one of which actually abuts a church, of all things. I forget the denomination, but it's almost impossible for someone who's new to the area not to remark on the just unbelievable geographic and land zoning irony of such a juxtaposition. So you have like a Value Village secondhand shop, you got the Ripper joint, you got the strippers, and then you got this House of God. So it's really wild. And although it's been, I'm definitely several years removed from darkening the door of any sort of strip club, but it always struck me whenever I would that I would be sort of like, you can't help but remark when you're sitting there, like, look at all these sleaze bags, which is paradoxical and ironic because you could include yourself in that equation. Like, you're drawn there as well. The whole scheme, the whole setup is demeaning is not the right word, as that's kind of obvious, and it doesn't give people moral agency who choose to do this line of work. Many women do, many are thrust into it by drug addiction and whatnot, but there's a certain, just, I don't know, it's definitely not humanity at its best. Let's put it that way. It's not the most life-affirming place to be. You could probably say the same about Ultimate Fighting Championship, where you watch two people beat the living bejesus out of one another. It's not anything that emboldens the human condition. It's not that there's something... I mean, there's definitely something transgressive about it, and there's something I find personally, like I feel unsafe in there, which is weird because it's really the girls who should, but I don't like being solicited. There's a lot of like goonish behavior. The patrons who go there frequently, especially the ones who are regulars, or can be very terrifying. I've had experiences abroad that have been really... quite unnerving. Once in New Orleans, which is a kind of a seedy place as well, at the best of times in parts, but also in Bratislava and the Czech Republic, and where these strip clubs are not as well developed as a scene as they are in North America, but mostly they're just really a front for out-and-out prostitution. And that can be really something to behold. It's just a completely different scene. It's something that's really seedy. And of course, exploitation films have exploited this, I mean, hence the name, on multiple occasions, and you see this set up like constantly. So you have these two women who work these clubs, and you get a lot of pole dancing, and you got a lot of the clients, and one makes, and we're going to segue into what we learned briefly, but one says, like, makes some racist remark to Zola about how she resembles, I forget which actress it is, but totally inappropriate and totally off the mark, like missing the mark. But what's interesting about this film is that, again, nobody learns anything. You just are going along for the ride. In many respects, actually, Zola has more in common with the likes of Keanu Reeves in Speed, of all things, because you're getting just a pedal to the metal, adrenaline rush, and you're getting a juxtaposition of, I think, guerrilla filmmaking with, I think, really, grounded and educated level of filmmaking as well. So the filmmaker is Janixa Bravo. I'm not familiar with her work, but she's definitely informed by 70s sensibilities. And so you get this stuff where you almost have this guerrilla style, like point the camera out the window kind of vibe, but then you also have very beautiful shots as well. So it, I think, perfectly marries the extemporaneous and also the thoroughly planned out. So, you know, I'm not saying she's a Stanley Kubrick or anything, but she has a definite auteur eye when you look to these things, and being in control of this, because tonally, again, Zola is really all over the map, but they do go there insofar as the one character, the white bitch, actually speaks in a very black vernacular, and you would think, you know, okay, for these you know, heady times and this politically correct, very woke world, you wouldn't be able to get away with that. But it seems to me on point with her colleagues and the situation in which she finds herself, because I guess this film is in predominantly black Detroit, and then they venture down to the south as part of this road trip, and there's pretty on point, a Nigerian pimp who is basically orchestrating this whole thing, and whose jeep they go in to make this long journey south. There's also a boyfriend whose name escapes me. I can't remember whether it was Jared in the original or Dustin in the movie version. I can't recall, but he's just one of these. He turns out through the course of this film that he's sort of cuckolded, because the white bitch is actually eventually drawn into a hoe trap, which is like a honey trap where you're compelled and cajoled into the world of prostitution through promises of other means to make money. This is actually a common problem with human trafficking or with migrant labor, because you're brought in to do one thing, let's say clean houses or work menial jobs, and then you find yourself in a situation from which you can't escape. So that said, you would think, okay, there's a movie in which someone is drawn into prostitution. You'd think, okay, this is going to be a film that's very, very morose and very dour and very dark. And yes, Zola has moments like that, but that is coupled with moments of levity and, I mean, dare I say it, like gallows humor fun that really puts this in a different category altogether and makes this a wholly unique beast. I mean, I never thought in a million years when I saw the premise of this film that this would be I mean, I think it actually pushes the limit of what can be described as appropriate, because it does, I think, whitewash, if you'll pardon the expression, or I think files down the edges a little bit of this seriousness and danger that surrounds prostitution, especially at the street level. We're not talking about high-end call girls who have like one or two clients to pay their university tuition or whatever. We're talking about working the street, working girls in very dangerous, very dark circumstances. And in one situation in Zola, there's actually a montage that's almost, dare I say, happy-go-lucky, in which the white bitch character is basically spreading her legs for thousands of dollars in this divey motel down in South Florida. And there's a montage of like male organs and of varying shapes and sizes and clientele of varying ages and financial backgrounds. And it just, the way that that was done as a montage, I think that probably detracts from the seriousness of the proceedings, because while it's fine and well to have gallows humor and have dark humor, I think you can tonally get caught up in these little situations if you make it too goofy in a way. But the characters are so well-rounded and so good. You'd think, okay, there's just this pimp and this guy is just going to beat the hell out of his girls and just be this complete sadist and raging, spittle at the mouth, fly off the handle, but actually not the case. He's played against type, and against type is something that's almost the theme of this podcast, because this is a movie that surprises at pretty much every turn. Everywhere you go and you think you're going to see someone do something, it's not the case. So this pimp character is Abegunde X Olewale, and he has a Nigerian accent that comes and goes, and I'm not speaking to put down the actor Coleman Domingo. This is actually part of his character, and he sort of adopts a very American vernacular when it suits him, and then back to the homeland kind of accent, his more natural speaking voice. So that's in of itself is interesting, and he could have just been, again, a stereotypical just abusive creep, as you would get in maybe Harvey Keitel in Taxi Driver, one of these sort of more flat, muted characters. But he's almost, dare I say, charming, for the lack of a better word. Taylor Page as Asia Zola King is wonderful. I mean, she's beautiful, and she has a certain vulnerability to her, and she really straddles, no pun intended, the role as someone who has, by no fault of her own, been stuck in a circumstance where she's really desperate for money and working at Hooters and not really paying the bills enough. But also when you're a stripper, that can be a gateway drug, as it were, into far more serious things, and it typically leads into a pornography. Now, I had a friend back in the day whose girlfriend went on to become a very internationally renowned porn star, and how that happened is she backslid into a life of cocaine abuse and stripping in just southwest of Toronto here. So I'm not going to name names, but this is something that was incredibly difficult to get out of, and it's a scene that is so self-contained and so ugly and sinister that it really you become the allure of just quick and easy money just becomes too much. Now, Riley Keough as Stephanie, or the white bitch, is absolutely amazing as well. She's a California actress, and she's been in a few things. Like there's a Magic Mike, which I haven't seen the whole thing, even though I really, really, really dig Steven Soderbergh movies. But probably best known for Mad Max Fury Road, which is a phenomenal film. But she's dynamite as this stripper turned prostitute, and her boyfriend is, again, this just sort of meek, put upon, cuckolded character who can't, I don't know if it's willfully ignorant, or he seems to be oblivious to the fact that his girlfriend, his longtime girlfriend, who has been effectively turned out before his very eyes. And her character is actually the linchpin around which Zola revolves, despite not being the eponymous character, and because she actually has to do this line of work because she has a very, very young son at home. I believe it could be a toddler. I could be wrong, but it just adds a level of sadness to this. But again, just a mix of laughs, but also just a pervasive atmosphere of foreboding and just, but again, put against this backdrop of, I mean, South Florida. I'm not really too much of a fan of Florida. I mean, there's that web meme of Florida Man, because there's just so much craziness down there. I'm fairly familiar with Tampa, as I have some relatives who got a place down in Marco Island, and so I've ventured down there a few times. There's something about Florida I find very off-putting. There's just something, for all its natural beauty in points in the Everglades and some of the nice beaches, there's a sinister underbelly that really manifests itself in places like Orlando and Jacksonville that are just really just dumpy as all hell. There are nice pockets, as there are anywhere, but I think this is actually a really good spot to host to set this movie, because it would have been far different had they been doing something different and been in a different part of the North American landscape. So kudos there. And again, the performances are off the charts, really good. This is a wholly unique, sui generis sex worker type movie. I mean, it really keeps you engaged. And I want to mention Quentin Tarantino again, because I think he wishes he could imbue a movie with this kind of atmosphere while infusing it with 70s sensibilities and making it wholly modern, because I just think that Tarantino is too in love with his own voice to really voice each of his characters individually enough so that they really stand out. Like, I never feel like I'm removed from hearing QT's voice in my head, and he's a dynamite filmmaker in his own right, and you can't go wrong with some of his efforts. They're undoubtedly amazing movies, but that it's always stuck with me and stuck in my craw that when he's written something, there's a certain sameness to it. He's not very versatile. He's not particularly good at it, I don't think, in a way that maybe a Woody Allen is. I just think he's just too in love with his own pen, and he needs an editor in the same way I think that Rob Zombie does, in a way that there's a sameness to his output, although obviously Tarantino movies are far, far superior. But both of these movies, and I alluded to them, A Most Beautiful Island and Zola, are both female directed, and it would have been interesting to see a male take on this, because what you really have is someone who I think in the director's chair gives these women a bit more moral agency to be able to make their own choices, because I think even the most naive, like bumpkin getting off a bus in like Los Angeles or something, would realize that in some respect they could be victims of predatory men, right? You got to figure. So I think there's an element of danger that strippers, I think, are able to countenance and are able to almost justify in a way. And I think it's par for the course. I'm sure they've seen many colleagues fall down the path to harder drugs and prostitution and getting themselves into more serious trouble. I mean, it's not a career path that lends itself to consistently paying down your 401ks and to early retirement and that. But it's a very difficult life and very tragic, and speaks to many, many issues surrounding the way the economy is structured. But we won't get into that. Many, many things I learned about this, but I've already alluded to them. There's so many really incredible scenes, and even when the cuckolded boyfriend meets sort of a local goon who's the head of a gang, it's not par for the course. I think would be the gangster sort of exploiting this white suburban douchebag, but they actually bond in a 7-Eleven type place, and the gangster says, "Hey, I saw you with these two hot chicks. You're obviously kind of the man in a way," and that conceit was something where I didn't see coming. Many things I didn't see coming in this film, because this gangster character has it might actually be the area code for Tampa, like tattooed across his forehead. You know he's up to no good, but he's actually an affable kind of guy, and their interactions are actually quite unique and quite compelling, and every character in this movie is really well done. It's hard to know what else to say about it, really, other than maybe an unsatisfactory, kind of corny ending. And some people have taken umbrage with the final frame, in that it's almost Soprano-esque when, Don't Stop Believin' by Journey just cuts off a dinner that Tony Soprano is having with his family. Similarly here, you have one of the characters undergo this incident, you know, without spoiling it. And some critics have said that this leaves stones unturned. I would tend to disagree, because I think it kind of speaks to the transient nature of this kind of storytelling, and just the way that this is really a slice of life taking place over a very short slice of time. This is not someone with a character arc. This is not someone who's growing. This is not for your edification and someone who's going to become a better person overall. This is not a large, sprawling slice of Manhattan life, say, like Wolf of Wall Street, that captures a specific subset of humanity. This is more just a day in the life, and literally a day in the life, because this passes really quick over a day and a night, and there's no personal growth. I like that. It's just wham, bam. Thank you, ma'am. I guess in and out. Jeez, this is awful punning here, but this is tight, taut filmmaking, creative. Every frame is interesting in its own way. The character is very, very believable. Every time they lead you into what you think could be a rhetorical and creative cul-de-sac, they emerge with something that you least expect. So dynamite, kudos on this one. I'm going to give this one probably 3 4/5. I'm going to give this almost 4. Let's say 3 3/4 out of 5. This is well worth your time. It's something that I've never seen before, and it is a very, very modern take on the exploitation genre, and it's something that you might have seen with like a Women's Prison Massacre or that kind of one of these 70s movies with pimps and hoes and that type of thing that was so common in the blaxploitation, particularly period when it really came in vogue in the mid-70s, and though these things were being shown all over the Deuce and Times Square in New York City and that, so they're really is, it takes some of those sensibilities, puts it in the current day, doesn't lecture us, doesn't have any silly exposition, just is what it is, unabashedly entertaining and dark, and really, really well done. So again, thanks again. We're going to return to some of our horror roots for next week's episode. This is a nice detour because we're all about exploitation of all stripes on the podcast. Continue to enjoy new episodes, of course. Thanks for all the new listeners who've tuned in. New episodes uploaded for your listening pleasure every Friday by yours truly, getting Jeff on board shortly, my longtime co-host on the podcast, as we continue to bring you horror, action, exploitation, all sorts of film talk on the show, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care.